Hi, I'm Don Galini, and I'm representing the RIT Venture Fund. And I guess about maybe 6 months ago, RIT launched a $3.5 million fund, and we're looking to invest in growth-oriented companies in mainly in the Rochester area. The main criteria is that there's a link to RIT. So we're looking for businesses that are formed by students, by faculty, by alum, coming out of venture creations. So as long as there's some kind of connection to RIT, it's eligible. The other criteria is just that we're looking for growth-oriented companies. So typically looking for a 10x return in about a five-year period. So you need a business plan that supports that kind of growth. And we'll probably be making 8 to 10 investments over a 3 to 5 year period.
Hi, I'm Matt Tipple. I'm representing the Signing School Fund. We're a new fund, so we're probably about 6 months old. We've got $1 million that was provided through a generous donation from one of our alumni. Like the RIT fund, I'd say we're looking for startup companies that may have some connection to the U of R or the Rochester community. It just makes things a lot easier. However, we're not hamstrung by that. We don't have any strict rules against that. We are interested in technology, but also anything really. I think the difference with our fund is we're not only looking for the investment ROI, but we're also looking for an educational ROI for students who are involved. The students make the decision, more or less. I mean, there's some controls in place for the university, but it's really meant to be a fund in which the students can make decisions and do due diligence and work with all these great guys up here to learn about venture capital investing or learn what it's like to be on the other side of the table as an entrepreneur. And that's really what our focus is. So not only will we be looking at the likely outcome or return from an investment standpoint, but we'll also consider things that may increase what we think about as the educational ROI for the fund.
Now, just since you've got the microphone there, could I just ask you about what sort of level of business plan are you looking for example, as a new fund starting out? What sort of expectations do you have about people who are proposing, coming to you looking for some capital?
It's a good question. I think that probably like many other funds, we do have concerns about management. We like to see some gray hair somehow involved, either an advisor or board member. If I can talk a little bit about who manages the fund, it's the students, but we also have an all-star board with a CFO from a Boston-based venture capital fund. We've got some leaders from within the university, folks like Dennis Kessler, who's an entrepreneur and a teacher. And also, we lean heavily on, Rami and Jim and Don here locally. So we won't really give money just to someone who's got a great idea. We do look for a little gray hair and that sort of thing. But that said, the nice thing about having a young management team is it may offer some experience opportunities for the students at Simon that an established team may not. So we look at both things.
Right. Is it, I guess, the scale of the funding, does that, I guess, allow you to take, I mean, what's your level of risk management? Or, what do you see as being a kind of acceptable level of risk within, when you're assessing those kinds of proposals?
We're really early on in terms of where we are. The fund itself is probably going to invest about $100,000 a year is the goal. So that's not really enough, really, for an established company to live off of all by itself.
Yeah.
So we're looking to manage risk through, our own due diligence, but also partnering with local legal expertise or other fund managers. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that's good. Well, perhaps that's something that Don could pick up as well, because obviously you're looking for projects that have some relationship to RIT or the RIT orbit. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit more, I guess, what do you see as being the sort of, the kind of strengths, mm-hmm. the strengths that you're looking to tap into at the moment?
Sure. I think when I look at a company, I think there's a few things that you look for. You certainly look for a strong leadership team to start with, and I think that's probably the most important thing in a lot of regards. You're really betting on the jockey many times. You also have to have a business plan that shows you have a reasonable market. You have a market that's big enough to support your projections. So it sounds obvious, but if you say you're going to be a $100 million company in 5 years, you have to be participating in a market that's much bigger than that, because you'll only get a small percentage of that if you're really successful. We also like to see a good value proposition. So we'd like to see that your business is proposing that it can do something 10 times better than what exists in the market today. So if you can tell a credible story that you're 10x better than what's off the shelf, it can be better, faster, cheaper, whatever, but you have a kind of an order of magnitude advantage over what's out there already, then that's compelling because people will be willing to make a change for a 10x improvement, but they might not be willing to make a change or pay more for a 2x improvement. And lastly, you look for a competitive advantage. You'd like to have some kind of unfair advantage, some kind of patents, something that'll keep the competition away for some period of time. And it doesn't have to be a patent, but patents are nice. Some form of intellectual property. I think if a company comes to us with a strong story around those four pieces, then they have a reasonably good chance of getting money. I think there's two caveats that I can fold into that, though. One is the level of maturity of the technology. So if you have a strong story in all four of those areas, but then you say, but geez, we need 3 years and four inventions to get there, or we need FDA approval and we haven't even started the process yet, then it gets dangerous again. It sounds expensive to investors. So that's one thing that, you know, you talk about level of risk. You'd like to see that the inventors or the company has secured maybe government grants or some other form of financing to get to the point where they've de-risked it and developed the technology far enough so that it's ready for more institutional investment, equity investment. And the last piece that I think can be dangerous is when inventors or startups have an unrealistic expectation of valuation. So you've never sold anything, you don't have any patents, and you have two people in a garage and you think your business is worth $10 million today, you're probably going to have trouble raising money from investors. So that, again, having a realistic expectation of valuation is another important element.
Right. Jim, Don's mentioned this point of, I guess, it can be useful for startup ventures to also have perhaps had some sort of confidence or vote of confidence from other sources of funding, like an innovation, a government innovation fund, that kind of thing. Is that something that you would look to, in particular projects, as saying, okay, well, this is, they've already done the hard yards, they've actually, they've put some proposals out there, they've got a little bit of initial funding. Is that attractive to you?
Sure. Any kind of expert or third-party validation helps.
Yep.
So if they've gotten SBIR awards and phase twos, someone has reviewed the technology to a certain extent. If they've gotten traction or a prior investment through another fund in Excel Partners or any other funds, that's a validation point. If they've gotten anything from a customer, a non-recurring engineering project where a customer's actually paid them money to do something, that's a huge one. So all those things are good validating factors. It helps when you're doing your due diligence. Nothing short circuits your guesswork more than somebody's actually giving them cash. That proves the value proposition a little bit. So not to say that all those things make it an automatic by any means, but they're all very helpful.
Yeah. Could you just talk a little bit about the stage you're at now with the closure of this of your angel fund? What was the kind of critical mass that you got to there to sort of be in this phase now?
Well, the fund will close with a little over $2 million initially. It'll be open for a little while longer, hopefully raise that a little bit higher. And so historically, the Angel Network, based on the deals we've done, has been investing $300,000 to $400,000 per deal. We'd really love to see that be a little bit higher. Now, of course, often we're syndicating with the folks here at the table or other angel groups or other seed funds. But we really wanted to, like I said before, broaden the participation rate. We've always had about 35 members within the Angel Network. You lose some each year, you gain some each year. But we saw a lot of advantages to having a fund, for example, having a dedicated due diligence committee, which is going to let us get through due diligence a lot faster. There might be entrepreneurs in the room who think the Angel Network moves slowly, which is probably true. It's definitely true. So a lot of advantages to providing a portfolio and de-risking the investors' investment by putting some of it into a fund, but they're also going to be able to invest alongside the fund. So as the fund leads on due diligence, all the other investors, and we're going to have, by the end of the day, probably 65 angel investors here in Rochester participating.
Uh-huh.
I think back when we first started the Angel Network, I went to New York City, New York Angels meeting set in, they had 75 members, and I just thought to myself, oh my God, that's like, we had 18, I think, at the time. How could we ever do this? This is New York City. Well, we're approaching those numbers, so it's really gratifying to see.
Rami, you mentioned you're interested in life sciences, which is obviously we know is a kind of strong a strong suit of central and upstate New York and the capital region, obviously. What are the kinds of, what are the sort of opportunities that you think, you know, that you think are there for life sciences and the opportunities for, you know, for investment that, that you're sort of looking to leverage?
So obviously, whenever it comes to life sciences, the big question is, does it require regulatory approval or not? So we, it may be detrimental to our future, but we did not shy away from ones that require FDA approval. Obviously, it should reflect the level of risk that we're taking on in terms of the valuation that we're coming in. But the sense is, because Excel is governed by a lot of the universities in upstate New York, University of Buffalo, RIT, U of R, Syracuse University, and Cornell, we can have access to a lot of technical expertise that can help expedite the research. Just today at Binghamton, we're looking at a sensor that the Department of Defense is looking for, point-of-care sensors that can diagnose within less than 15 minutes. That's a magical number. And nobody's been so far been able to break that, to best of our knowledge. So there's a new technology that may do that. Right? So it's a huge leap forward. They're probably 3 years away from market, a lot of requirement, et cetera. But I think we're comfortable enough that if we get a good lead and get start that with the resources that in upstate New York, because it is a mecca for life sciences, and I don't think people recognize the true strength that we have up here, as it can be done. And the flip side is, we have a lot of capital right now compared to what we used to have, not as much as downstate. So if you're competing with other regions where the growth is based on attracting capital, we will probably not prevail. We need to have a unique advantage that allows this venture to have kind of a sheltered life for a period of time until it grows. And that's something that is based on the strength of the patents and the technology. And that's why, I mean, if you look, Kauffman Institute looked at technology ventures. On average, they have about 6 patents per venture. Our ventures have slightly more than 11. Per se, it's not an indication of anything, except for the fact that they have either too much legal money, but they spend a lot in defending their science and coming up with strong science.
Right, yeah. I was going to ask a sort of a broader question to each of you on the panel about the regional relationships or the significance, obviously, of the powerhouse that is New York City, and how that factors into your thinking around potential partners going forward for a project or that kind of thing. So that perhaps you just...
Yeah. So thanks to organizations like UVaney and other, like the Levin Institute, are trying to bridge upstate and downstate capital. There's a lot of potential connections. I think there's more capital there than we have here. I think we have stronger IP and stronger technologies than you can see downstairs. So I can see a lot of synergy and a lot of potential collaboration.
Right. And I think there's certainly a sense of a stronger startup culture, I think, say in Syracuse, that we're now starting to see in Startup Alley, as they're calling it in New York City. Jim?
I'll just chime in on that. We haven't done a lot of co-investment to date. Brian Modell's here all the time, as he mentioned. Thank you, Brian. And we continue to try to co-invest. We have co-invested in some deals, actually with Brian's group, but we're looking to do more. The Launchpad Accelerator that HTR is managing right now, I see Mike and the teaching team here. We're going to do demo days here, but also in New York City at the Levin Institute. So we're trying to bridge the gap that way and bring some of our companies there, see if we can generate some interest.
Right. John?
Yeah, I guess what I've seen through the Rochester Angel Network, I think Buffalo and Syracuse and Rochester collaborate very nicely. The principals know each other well, like each other, and talk to each other. I think once the distance just makes Albany and New York a little bit more difficult to have ongoing discussions. But one interesting thing is, my perception at least, is that in New York, for example, they're very comfortable with software deals. And they see a lot more of them than we see in Western New York, where we'll see a lot more technology deals and a lot more life sciences deals. So there is an opportunity. So if we see software deals, to tap into our friends in the city, and they're very happy and welcome those kinds of interactions. They're happy to talk with us. So I think we have opportunities to not only leverage the dollars, but also leverage the expertise that resides in the different parts of the state.
Well, I just have to echo Don. I think, I've only been back in Rochester for a couple of years and looking at this sort of thing, but I think one of the places where the Rochester community could improve is to embrace software and some of these you know, conceivably, they're considered maybe higher risk types of startup companies that aren't based in manufacturing or optics or some type of healthcare science related business. I think if we can embrace that in upstate New York, it's only going to help bring entrepreneurs to the area. But in order to do that, we will have to partner with folks downstate or in Boston or on the West Coast somehow. So, and I know that the folks at the Rochester Angel Network at least do annual events where they're interacting with folks across the country in different angel groups, right?
And so, there's also a lot of interest in trying to get some of the, say, Boston area ventures over to here to places like Eastman Business Park, etc. Just moving on to another topic, which is management teams, and also what you look for. I guess, you know, does your fund look for a role as a director in some, you know, on some of the management teams or the boards that you'd be working with going forward?
No, I think, and I think from our standpoint, because it's primarily student run, there may be some liabilities or risks associated with having some real responsibility at the board level. What we look for is having an observatory type of role and the ability to help on projects and that sort of thing. In terms of the people who are on the boards at our investee companies, we're looking for established operators, board members who can really add value to the underlying company.
Right. Don, you're also, I guess, a kind of student LinkedIn or, you know, education environment more than the...
Yeah, I think it depends on when you come into the deal. I mean, for us, if we came into the deal early, we were a lead investor or one of the early investors, and certainly if we felt like we could make a contribution, we'd want a board seat. Yeah. But there are times when that's just not appropriate, and you couldn't insist on it, and you wouldn't insist on it. I think what's really important to Matt's point is you're looking for companies to have an awareness that they need a strong leadership team. And I think the biggest opportunity that's often missed by early-stage companies is that they need to form very strong advisory teams while they're writing the business plan. Before they make the first mistake, have strong legal representation, have strong accountants that have done corporate work, have someone that's done a startup before advise you as you're writing your plan, and that'll help you not only avoid mistakes, but it'll also prevent funds from saying you have no expertise involved in, and that'll scare people away. So not only will they require board seats, but they'll want more control. I think if they see that the early investors and the early team is supported by a strong advisory team, it puts us all at ease.
On the board seat issue or question, I think, again, the Angel Network usually is participating in co-investing with others.
Yep.
And so depending on who's kind of leading that deal and where the expertise is, that's where the board member likely would come from. Mm-hmm. With a group of 50 or 60 people, chances are we have people that have been in the industry and our expertise and can add value, either as a board member or an observer. But as typically, you know, the first outside money in the deals that we get into, usually there is a conversation about what the board will look like. It's no longer the five founders only.
Right.
You know, it's going to have some outside representation of investors, maybe an independent person.
Can I just ask you about how some businesses respond to that sort of reality of realizing, hey, it's not just you and, you know, your brother in the garage anymore? I mean, there must be some interesting sort of realizations there.
I think there are. I think when you have the check and you say, here's what the board has to look like, they listen a little more closely.
Right.
But I welcome other people's opinion on that.
We would typically take a board seat. That's for most deals. It's not mandatory. It depends on, again, who else is on the team and who has the better connections. The discussion typically with management, and I think we rank it in three key questions: that who in the broader team, preferably the founders or the management team, but who on the broader team has sold anything before? Who has sold something in this kind of industry? Or who had P&L, profit or loss, for someone who's kind of manage the business in this space, have this specific business development experience. And it's oftentimes, it's one of the key gaps we see in management teams. And it's something that is solvable because, I mean, you look around at the folks are in the room here, there's a lot of expertise and offering they're available for the price of a cup of coffee. Just pick up a phone, call somebody with the right resume, get their feedback. It'll save you a ton of mistakes and a ton of money in the future, and you may just get yourself a partner.
Okay, well, on that point, what do you see, I guess, what would you see as one of the main reasons for deals that don't ever get, you know, that don't get done? What are the things, where do they fall?
So it's management that has not walked down the path or did not have access to expertise, that has gone the path of how do I actually sell it from the time it leaves my lab all the way to the customer's hand. Who's going to pay for it? How much time will it take? And the other sometimes issue is this not willing to part of equity. I founded it. It's my idea. Ergo, I need to walk away with 90%. Or if you're looking at some significant return for us into the future, because 90% of the deals will fail, so you look at 10x return and you say, okay, if you are starting, you need to be at a very significant valuation in the future. If you're starting with a $10 million valuation right now, that means that 5 years from now, you need to be at least $200 million of value, because we account for 100% dilution by the time of the exit. Show me the handful of deals of companies like you that have been sold for $200 million, and if they're not, then probably your valuation is off.
Uh-huh. Jim, what are the reasons deals get done, don't get done?
Well, I think, you know, any number of reasons. Valuation can sometimes become one of those reasons, for all the reasons Rama just mentioned. I think oftentimes when we're in due diligence on a deal, we'll find maybe the market's not as big as we thought it was, or the entrepreneur indicated it was. Their solution is not as important to customers as, you know, they first thought it was. So once you start talking to customers and you start really understanding the true market size, those are some things that can sometimes quickly turn deals south a little bit. And then competition as well. Mm-hmm. What else is out there? Kind of all part of the market, but, you know, when you're told there's no competition and you pull up Google during the pitch.
Or you get blindsided by another product that comes out. Right.
Pull up Google while they're giving the pitch and you say, what about these five? And they say, who are they? You know,
right.
It's kind of,
right.
That makes the deal not happen.
Yeah, I think there's two schools of thought. I think, especially over the past several years, there's a lot of people that'll say, you don't need a business plan. Real VCs don't look at business plans. They see a 15-minute slide deck, and that's what they're investing in. And that may or may not be true, but I think the reason that companies don't get funded is because they don't write a good business plan. And whether they use that business plan, that 60-page business plan, is the thing that gets analyzed and the decisions made on or not, that may not be the case. But if you didn't write the 60-page business plan and you didn't get input from an advisory team, a well-rounded advisory team, and you didn't think through the competitive landscape and the value proposition and all the things that the investors are going to be looking for, if you haven't gone through that in a rigorous way, you probably missed something. And if you miss something, these guys are going to find it. And they might find it in a very uncomfortable way, like talking to your prospective customer. And for the first time over the phone, you'll hear your investors learn that the market's not as big, or the customer's not going to buy what they thought you thought. All kinds of things you can learn. And you don't want to learn that way, because once you've come to the investors prematurely, you haven't done the business planning, and you have all of these gaps, and you've exposed yourself to the investment community, then it's really hard to come back. It's hard to get people to not remember what happened 6 months ago, a year ago. So you can get into this really bad spot by coming to the investors before you've done your homework. So come back to, you know, form an advisory team while you're writing your business plan. Make sure the business plan is rock solid. And maybe no one will ever read it, but you'll have a good story. Your 15-minute pitch will be really good because you have the 60 pages that back it up.
Can I just make a comment? Just for entrepreneurs, just so you understand their side of the story, is if they like you, they've got to go through an internal thing with their partners and write their own internal documentation, look at the numbers, look at the returns, look at the risk trade-offs, then they've got to have a partners meeting, look at it, approve it. So that's the other side, that's why you're emphasizing that.
Good point.
So you understand how the other side of it works, not just your side.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a pretty skeptical crowd. So, you know, and there's people with a lot of different expertise you may or may not have. I think these guys have touched on pretty much everything. But one thing I will say is the people that are presenting and how responsive they are, how straightforward they are, how forthright they are with information, I think goes a long way. It may not get a deal done, but you can certainly kill a deal by not being willing to give information or dancing around subjects or you know, not being able to justify financial projections, things like that. I think that's where we've seen people really fall down flat. When we just say, hey, you know, especially a company that's near revenue or at revenue, if they can't produce a balance sheet or financial statement as to what they've done this year, I mean, this should be what they're living, eating, sleeping. So if they can't produce that kind of information, then it doesn't give people like us a lot of confidence in their ability to manage the business and look out for things to come.
So on the flip side of that, do you all sign non-disclosure agreements, or are you prepared to sign non-disclosure agreements in this process?
When asked, but it's funny. We, you know, sometimes I've seen, just again, it's only been a few months here, but we've seen some great companies come through that haven't required it.
Right.
And so there's sort of a general agreement there, but we do sign non-disclosure agreements. And those, from a student perspective, one of the things the board at the Simon Fund does is we really instill the seriousness of those agreements, and we make sure as new students become involved that they accept and understand those non-disclosure agreements.
Right. Don, what's the
RIT fund would probably not sign an NDA to see a business plan. I mean, you know, you have to remember that the numbers game that we end up playing is you see about 100 deals to fund a couple. So to sign 100 NDAs, if everyone asked you to, before you even saw the business model, it wouldn't be practical. It'd be very hard to make sure that you stay true to that. So I wouldn't want to be asked to sign an NDA to see the business plan. Now, I can imagine once you're deep in due diligence, you might have a technological, you know, a piece of information that we may need to test, and we may need to make sure that it's good, and we may need to sign the NDA deep once we're deep in negotiations to make sure some proprietary information is good, and then on a case by case we may be willing to do that. But as a general rule, that would come much later. We'd have to be very interested in the deal, and we might even ask a technical expert to sign the NDA and validate that it's good without ever disclosing it to us, because you don't want to be in a position to have too much.
The third party that you have confidence in.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
So I would echo everything Don said. So never at the first meeting, or probably even the second meeting. The Angel Network individuals, once it got deep into due diligence, have signed them.
Yep.
The fund, actually, we're not sure if can ever sign them based on the structure. So that's a new thing we're working our way through. Right, Jeff? but generally speaking, you know, there's nothing you need to share with investors in the first meeting or possibly two meetings. You should be telling them anything about your secret sauce. So,
and if I can just add on, that's where we do it at that stage too. Things like customer lists, or you know, if there's anything very specific that they don't want getting outside the group. But we would never do it just on the first business plan, because as these guys said, it's, you know, you get a lot of business plans. So.
Yeah, some people are like green. We have a 5-step due diligence process. We sign NDAs in step 4, so you have to go through steps 1, 2, 3 without that. And if you cannot tell the story. Boy, I'm a recovering attorney. I don't listen to long words when it comes to technology. I don't care how you do it. I care about what you do and what is the impact of that. So if you can't explain the impact of what you're doing without infringing on your IP, then your probably venture is so fragile that you will not make it out in the marketplace anyway.
Right. Hold on to that, Mike. Rami, we're going to open up the floor, perhaps for about 5 minutes of questions or comments from the floor. If you'd like to address the question. Yes, sir.
It's an exciting time. We've got $20 million within 60 miles of Rochester, but you're going to say no more than you're going to say yes. So can a couple of the panelists comment about the artist saying no?
Sure.
Oh, I'm so happy I have some pipe.
Rami can.
We try to be very blunt in the discussion, because there's no point of cuddling, right? I mean, we're trying to, in a nice way, and say, look, here's what you need to think about if this doesn't work. Or here's a failure point. I mean, when I was still at HDR, I used to say, the mantra that we shoot for is fail fast, fail cheap. The failure will be on both sides. On the entrepreneur, probably will see a lot of ideas and a lot of ventures before they come to any investors. And we'll invest in probably three, we invest in 3% of the deals we see. So 97% of the deals we'll say no to, right? So your goal as an entrepreneur, from my perspective, is get to the no or the yes, but sometimes the no, as fast as possible. Because then that will breed the next idea, the better idea that will eventually get funded. And otherwise, you're just wasting resources.
From an angel network standpoint, as you know, so I run the angel network, but I don't make investment decisions. So, of course, I think every deal that applies should get funded. But you investors, aren't as smart as I am, I guess. but the angel network, we do provide collective feedback. So anyone that comes and presents to the angel network, actually, after you leave, we have discussion. Every person in the room is asked to fill out a form. We, with scores and handwritten notes that we summarize and send back to you. So if nothing else, you've heard what a room of 30 people heard from you. Whether you agree with it or not, hopefully it's at least helpful to you and the experience was helpful.
Yeah, I think one of the most important attributes of a successful entrepreneur is to be coachable. And unfortunately, that normally doesn't come with the territory because I think the gene you need to be willing to go off and start a company usually is one that gives you tons of confidence and maybe makes you think you don't need much help. But I think that the ones who recognize they could use help and take the help are the ones that are more likely to be successful. So when you end up saying no, my experience, I have more experience with the Angel Network just because I've been doing it longer. But even within the RIT fund, when you see a business that you don't like, there are normally reasons why. And I think there's people who get involved in this kind of thing love working with early stage companies. They love working with entrepreneurs, and they have a strong tendency to want to try to help, find help for them within the community. Now, some people are good receivers of that information and do something with it, and others don't want to hear it. But I do think that in general in Rochester, what I've seen is there's a mentoring mentality. There's much more of an appetite of the investors to try to help businesses succeed, even if they don't make the investment.
Fortunately, I'm on the board, so I don't have to say no. But you know, it's something that we're working with students to talk to companies about. But it's something, to your point, Jeff, that we probably need to think about more in a good way to do that. We haven't really formalized it. But I would echo Don's comments that I think the great thing about Rochester is, you know, I might not give you money, but I can introduce you to this person who might be able to help you. And I think that's sort of the mantra for the community. So,
thank you. Question, comments? Yes, sir.
Like their reaction to, once you've made an investment, what do you do to assist that venture after that? Or are you too busy doing the next one?
I pass this down since we don't have one yet.
We don't have one yet either. We don't.
Well, I think we're a little different, again, as an angel group with that many people. So typically, if we're involved in a deal and we have several members that have invested or directly if the fund invests now, oftentimes we may have board members involved or we just may have investors that are involved helping. So the group has moved on to look at the next deals. Venomics is an example. Several members are on the board. Ron Zarella has been opening doors, and a lot of people have been opening doors because they know the industry and the players. That's kind of the involvement level. Anyone that's got money in the deal wants to see it succeed. And when you can pull on a group of 50 or 60 people that have connections all over the world, that's hopefully a value add that we're bringing.
That will depend on the situation of the company. I mean, the perfect scenario is call us a day before you go public, right? But that rarely happens. So our engagement rate ranges anywhere between sometimes it can be there are a few ventures, luckily not too many, that we are almost on a daily basis in them. So we are kind of sitting side by side with management at least once a week, not twice or three times a week. And a comfortable place will be to meet roughly once a quarter to get an assessment, face-to-face to get progress, and kind of going like once a month roughly to get a general overview. But it depends. We are in the, right now, I'm sending out emails to invite, we're recruiting a CEO for one of our ventures in Buffalo, so we have candidates from Boston, Chicago, Florida, and forget the other place. And it's up to the point that we are, our office manager is managing the accommodations for the travel, right? Because that's what we do. My partner in crime and the head of the fund, Teresa Mazzullo, has a very, very extensive network of folks, and she'll come to take you all the way to open business development doors if need be. Find the way to access to the next partner, to the manufacturing partner, on a distribution partner. So it depends. Again, we will be very happy to stay away and take a step back. But sometimes you really need to take up and almost be engaged on day-to-day operations.
Okay. Yes, sir. Last one.
I have questions for Jim.
Oh, lucky me, Jerry.
with the new fund, the new Rochester Training Group fund, are you still going to offer the other solution, which is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so his question was, can you still be an individual Angel Network member now that the fund is in existence? And the answer is yes. Most of our members are investing in the fund as well for diversification. But yeah, and a lot of members are very excited to be into Sweetwater too.
Thanks, Jim. I'm sure all the panelists are available to canvas your questions or comments or bend your ear once we've finished the formal proceedings and we're into networking. Did you want to sign up, sir? I'd like to thank all the panelists, and I'm sure that's what Sam's about to do.
Okay, we're going to thank all the panelists.